was too much. I opened the door and saw her facing Jennifer with her hands on her hips. I said, "What's the X-Pot from the Diamond Exchange?" She realized she'd slipped up and said,
"Nothing. He took a girl from the Diamond Exchange with him. It's why I stayed behind. She had the knowledge he needed."
"Do you know who she worked for?"
"Pike, I can't talk about it."
After all we'd done for her, completely outside of our mandate, to include putting my team in jeopardy, the answer aggravated me. The stonewalling was too much. I said, "Right, Carrie, it's all secret. You know, we might have solved this a little earlier if you'd bother to answer your phone for a dinner date. But I forgot you were on your honeymoon." I said the word while using my fingers to make air quotes. She turned red, balled her fists up, and I thought for a fleeting moment she was going to attack. Instead, she started to brush past me, and I swear I thought I saw her eyes water. But that was impossible. Carrie didn't cry. Jennifer, having the intuition that I was lacking, gave me a look of pure venom. I realized using the call sign she'd earned on another mission, because she was borderline psychotic, and disparaging her relationship with Aaron had hit a lot harder than I'd intended. But how could I know that Shoshana actually had feelings? She'd never had before. Jennifer grabbed Shoshana's arm, preventing her from leaving. Shoshana started to jerk it free, and I held up my hand saying, "Whoa, Shoshana, wait." She said,
"Fuck you."
To Jennifer,
"Let go of my arm, Coco, I mean it."
Jennifer did, and before I could stop her, she said,
"Shoshana, our target went into the Diamond Exchange. We couldn't follow, but the coincidence is too much."
That brought Shoshana up short. She looked at me, then went back to Jennifer. Jennifer said,
"What was Aaron doing? What were you doing? Tell me who you were following."
I said, "Carrie, cut the shit. You want to solve this, you work with us, not the other way around." Jennifer looked alarmed at my tone, but I knew I was on solid ground now. No disparagement, pure mission. Shoshana would understand that. She glared at me, and I said, "I apologize for what I said before." That worked the opposite of what I wanted, like she was hiding the fact that it even mattered. She tensed up, her muscles vibrating, and said,
"I don't need this. I'll save Aaron myself."
She tried to go past me, and I blocked her. She said,
"Get the fuck out of the way, Nephilim. I don't want to harm you."
I looked into her eyes, getting her to read me, knowing she would. I said, "I want to help you. Help Aaron. Like I did yesterday. Don't treat me as the enemy. I didn't mean what I said. I would never hurt you on purpose." She tensed up, and I refused to raise my arms, even though every single fiber of my being wanted to protect myself from her inevitable attack. I felt her weird glow float over me, and then she sagged back against our small desk. Whew! I had won. 27. Shoshana said,
"I don't know what he was doing. He got the mission and determined I wasn't viable to help. It was tied into the Diamond Exchange, but it wasn't anything violent. He was doing something to prevent the embarrassment of the state, nothing more. It was an economic mission, not national security. Someone in the exchange was doing something that would cause repercussions to the exchange's honor code and reputation."
I said, "Do you know who it was? I mean, inside the exchange?" She perked up, saying,
"No, but I can find out. I'll contact our control at Mossad. They'll know."
I shook my head. "You can't do that. Think about it. Why are you asking? Because someone attacked you? And how did you get away? Because of an unsanctioned U.S. mission on Israeli soil? That's not happening." She snarled,
"Fuck your task force. If it means saving Aaron, you'll have to take the repercussions. You don't like it? Get on a plane right now. You'll be out of the country before anyone can react."
Jennifer was taken aback at the ferocity. She said,
"Wait a minute. You'd throw us to the wolves? After Pike disobeyed orders to save you?"
Shoshana looked at her, then nodded, saying,
"Yes. Would you not do the same for Nephilim?"
Jennifer gave no answer, and Shoshana said,
"Of course you would. You can hate me if you want, but Aaron means more to me than your emotions or your organization. I need to leave. I need to contact the Mossad for the man Aaron was sent to investigate."
She looked at me and said,
"Don't fight me, Nephilim. Let me go."
I stepped aside and said, "Sure. Head on over to Aaron's control. See what you get." She hesitated, and I continued, "Why wasn't the Mossad used on this? If it was so important, why use a contractor?" She said,
"Because they wanted a cutout. It's standard operating procedure, you know that."
"And why is it standard procedure?" She said nothing. I said, "Because they wanted a cutout. You just said that. Why the cutout?" She just looked at me. I said, "Shoshana?" She said,
"Because they didn't want any official Mossad hand on the problem."
I nodded. "Think about what you just said. If something went wrong, they could disavow any official Israeli response, correct?" She didn't answer, and so I continued driving home the knife. "If Aaron is in danger, why are you finding out about this because of an attack on you? Why didn't the Mossad contact you after he disappeared?" She remained mute, and I said, "You know why, just as I do. Because they used him as they intended. He was a throwaway, and when things went bad, they did just that."
She said, "No, they will help. They are Israeli."
I grabbed her arms in my hands and leaned into her face, aggravated at her naivete, knowing it was nothing more than hope. Shocked, Jennifer leapt forward. I flicked my head to her and snapped, "Back off." She did, unsure of what was about to occur. Jennifer knew beyond any doubt, no matter what happened, that I would move heaven and earth to do whatever was required to help her. Because of that, she assumed that the organization we worked for would do the same. She was wrong, and Shoshana alone understood that. More so than me. I knew her history. I returned to Shoshana and locked eyes with her. She made no move to resist. I said, "They will not help. They put Aaron into play precisely so they could cut him free. If you go to them, if you make a stink, they'll react, no doubt. But it might not be the way you envision. They might cut him off completely, cause him to be killed." She half-heartedly struggled to get free, saying,
"They would never do that."
I said, "You mean like they didn't with you?" She stopped moving and looked at me, and I felt the weird glow. I said, "I understand loyalty. I understand a unit's mission. But some things supersede that, and you know it. We are those things, damn it. We mean more than the Mossad, Jennifer and me, and you." She sagged, no longer offering any resistance. She said,
"Okay, Nephilim, okay, what's next?"
I said, "Let the task force do its work. Let's get a thread instead of hauling off half-assed. Aaron is tied in to our mission. I don't know why, but let's use what we have. You can't get anything out of the Mossad, but you have us. Use that." I dropped my arms from her, and she looked at Jennifer, then back to me. She said,
"You mean that?"
"I do. And I know you know that. So cut the shit." She tried to hide a smile, then said,
"I thought you didn't believe in me."
"I don't. But I know you do." Like a light switch had turned off, she became feral again, saying,
"Don't make fun of me."
I saw it and put the reaction in my back pocket. However good she was operationally, she had turned a corner with Aaron being gone. She was no longer on an even keel. It was something to remember. Jennifer stepped in, saying,
"Shoshana, come on."
Shoshana looked like she was willing to take the fight even to Jennifer. I had seen enough. I said, "Carrie?" And she glared at me. I repeated, "Carrie, we're on your side. We showed that yesterday. Let the task force do its work." The computer on our desk began bleeding. It was our VPN chirping, along with a download from the task force. The invisible hand of the United States was at work, and its reach was vast. I said, "There you go, they're calling now. Let me talk to the task force, and then decide if you want to go off half-cocked on your quest for Aaron." She said,
"Do you really want to help me? or are you just preventing me from screwing up your mission?
Jennifer said,
You know better than that.
She nodded, then said,
Okay, but make no mistake, my mission is Aaron, and if our paths diverge, if your mission comes crossways with mine, I'll do whatever it takes to save him.
I punched the accept button on the computer, saying, Yeah, shut up. I can't have the task force know you're in the room. Before the screen cleared, she touched my shoulder. I looked at her and saw nothing but death. She said,
Nephilim, I mean that. Don't cross me. If it comes to it, I will do to you what you would do to me to save Jennifer.
Jennifer looked confused at the statement. Shoshana's eyes were as cold as stone in a river. I knew she was serious because her statement was true. I would do what she said if the roles were reversed. I reached up and softly touched her cheek. It will never come to that. Ever. She was shocked at the gesture, but I meant it. She smiled. A little bit of the feral still there. And I said, Get away from the fucking screen. She backed off, and I leaned in to hear what the task force had found.
28. Johann poured a drink from the hotel minibar, waiting on the stored video footage from the Mavic Pro to download. It was an amazing system, designed and innovated by market demands, and as such, was a technological feat that the slovenly procurement system of any military simply could not produce. By the time they had something like the Mavic would be in edition number 12. Maybe that edition would work data at exponential speeds, but the Mavic he had was still transferring the video to his MacBook at a decidedly mundane rate. After landing, Johann had spent 8 long hours driving around Maseru, pinpointing and recording the grid of the locations the team would need to neutralize. Weak links in the chain and specific points of failure that were the underpinnings of the entire government. It would seem ridiculous for a force of fewer than 100 to attempt such a thing, but unlike other countries with multiple centers of gravity, such as the United States, Lesotho had essentially won, the capital city of Maseru. All power radiated out from there, with every other village being simply a satellite that rotated around the host. Cut the weak links inside Maseru, and the rest of the country would fall in line. Do it right, and they wouldn't even be aware of a change until it was already a fait accompli. The Prime Minister's residence and Parliament were first, of course, but those were the no-brainers. Others were less obvious, but just as critical, such as the lone Lesotho television and radio station, and the sole internet provider. Stop the flow of information, and stop anyone from even knowing a coup was in progress. In addition to the levers of information and government, he had to prevent the engagement of the one martial arm the Prime Minister commanded, the Maseru Police, and that meant the police headquarters building. Johann couldn't attack all the stations in the city, but he could prevent the central command from issuing orders, which would be critical. While General Masebo would guarantee no military would respond, the police were another story, as the Prime Minister had made a concerted effort over the last year to co-opt them, precisely because he feared General Masebo's growing power base within the Lesotho Defense Force. Finally, Johann had to pinpoint the location of no-fire zones, areas that would remain neutral and stay out of the fight, unless Johann's men carelessly provoked them. Top of this list was the U.S. Embassy. He knew that the U.S. Ambassador was currently backing the Prime Minister in his spat to have General Masebo removed from the head of the LDF. And that backing had teeth, with millions in aid money being used as a bargaining chip. This had led to most of the Parliament siding with the Prime Minister, and had left Masebo out in the cold. The embassy would sit out the violence, hiding in their enclosure, but only if they didn't feel threatened. If they did, Johann's men might be facing a battalion of Marines, ostensibly to protect the embassy, but more likely to project American influence. The key was not to give them an excuse. Other countries' embassies were marked as well, but only because they could cause issues with the consolidation of power. They had no force projection capability, but they most certainly could withhold recognizing the new government, acting in a tiff because some of Masebo's men had dropped an errant mortar into their compound. After he'd finished getting the grids to all the locations, he'd come back to his hotel and loaded the destinations into the Mavic Pro. Attaching his smartphone to the controller, he'd taken it out on his balcony and then sent the drone flying. The thing was a marvel of technology that beat any military system he'd ever worked with. With a 30-minute flight time, a 7-kilometer range, software-driven obstacle avoidance, and a high-resolution gimbal-stabilized camera, he could cover every target he'd located on the ground from his hotel balcony, getting video that would be more useful for assault planning than the top-secret satellite images he'd used in the past. He'd had to swap batteries twice, but eventually he had a bird's-eye view of every target to complement his on-the-ground reconnaissance. He was satisfied with the work and was about to contact the team in Cape Town to learn their progress when he heard a knock on the door to his hotel room. He closed the computer, glancing at the gear strewn around his bed, thinking of hiding it. He went to the door first. He regretted it the moment he put his eye to the peephole. Outside were three thugs, tall and meaty, with close-cropped afros. And they weren't in any type of uniform. They weren't maintenance or hotel staff, which meant they had the wrong door, or he was in trouble. Through the door he said, "Can I help you?" He heard, "Mr. von Rensburg?" Shit. Johann glanced back, wishing he'd taken the time to sterilize his room. The drone was on the bed with the computer attached to it by a USB cable. Next to the window was the drop zone beacon, working through its software and GPS signal. No time to stall, idiot. Why did you ask the question? In intelligence, it was always the little things that caught you. Complacency, something he'd taken advantage of with the Israeli not 2 days before. And now he was guilty. He thought about running to the bed and furiously cleaning what he had, but he wouldn't be able to hide the systems in a place they wouldn't find with a minimal search. Even if he could, they might have a key, and if they did, they'd come in only to find him shoving everything under the bed. He said, "Yes? Can I help you?" "Open the door. We have some questions." He paused and said, "Pardon me?" "Open the door. We're from Lesotho Security and we have some questions related to your safety. Please. We mean no harm. We can do it right here in the hallway." Lesotho Security? What the hell does that mean? "I'm sorry. I'm not in the habit of opening the door to strangers in a foreign land. Let me call the front desk." He put his eye to the peephole and saw the lead Neanderthal grin. He heard, "Do it. We'll wait." Shit. They're real. There was no way they'd bluff this far. They'd already talked to the front desk and had cowed whoever was there. He heard, "Johann, you still there?" Thinking furiously, he said, "Yes, I'm here." "This won't take a moment. The longer you stall us, the more we fear for your safety." What a fucking lie. He made his decision. Get in the hallway and close the door. Let them talk to him out there. Don't let them in the room. If he couldn't defuse what they had in mind, then he was screwed anyway. If they demanded to go in the room, he, in turn, would demand hotel personnel accompany them. which should at least give them pause. He flung open the door and pushed past them, jerking it closed. He said, "What on earth are you talking about? Why are you here?" They circled him, and one, taller than the others, leaned in and said, "Are you Johann von Rensburg?" "Yes, you know that. What's this about?" "It's about your non-standard travel today. It's about your work for the Americans." "Americans? What the hell?" It wasn't lost on him that it was the second time he'd heard that word in the last 2 days. America cared as much about Africa as it did for a nose hair that had grown too long. And yet he'd had an American interdict his team in Tel Aviv, and now he had a bunch of thugs accusing him of the same. He said, "I'm not American. I'm South African." "Passport?" He handed it over. Now sure, he was in the clear. Whatever the Americans were up to here, it had nothing to do with him. The brute took it and said, "Follow me." Johann said, "Wait, what? I'm not going anywhere." The man held up his passport and said, "Yes, you are, if you want to get this back." Johann was now sure that they were from the Lesotho police, and he'd been tracked somehow. And if they suspected anything, they'd confirm it with the evidence in his room. He needed to prevent that. They hadn't asked for his key, which was a plus. If he refused, they might. He was sure he could win a battle of wits alone at police headquarters, but he couldn't if they confronted him with his equipment. Johann said, "Okay, okay. What do you want to talk about?" "We could do it at the bar." "Not the bar. We have a place that's secure, some place you'll be safe." Johann saw his face and knew it had nothing to do with being safe, and everything to do with controlling the environment. The easy answer would be, "No, let's do it right here, in my room." But that was a non-starter. So far, they'd made no move to open his door. Go or not? He decided to go. They had thought he was American, and when he'd proved he wasn't, it had altered their calculation. They had an order, which was to bring him in for questioning, and they'd execute that order, even if their information was wrong. He'd talk to the man calling the shots. Once that guy saw his passport, he'd be cut free. He said, "Okay, but I can't stay long. I have a dinner reservation upstairs. Are you going to let me make that?" "Yes, of course. We only want to protect you." "Right." They left the hotel, Johann sandwiched in the back of an SUV between two thugs who never smiled. They wound around the city streets and then headed into the country. The drive began to confuse him. If they were police, he should have traveled to their headquarters, a location he now knew intimately. They didn't. They pulled onto a dirt track outside an 8-foot-tall barbed wire fence, and Johann recognized the location. Set against the backdrop of a high ridgeline, it was the Makuanyane military base, the location of the headquarters of General Masibo's Special Forces Company, the very people his men were training outside of Cape Town. What the hell? 29. They drove through the gate, the soldier manning it looking intently at Johann, probably the only white man he'd seen today, and then wound around a dirt track weaving between concrete buildings. They stopped outside of a U-shaped structure set off on its own, surrounded by woods, the wings made of cinder blocks and crumbling. The driver parked, and the thug on the left exited the vehicle, waving him to get out. He did so and was immediately flanked by the other men, one on each side and one in the back. They led him toward the south wing, the portico crumbling with age, and into a space that looked like a classroom. The walls were covered with sheets, hiding what was behind them. But he could make out an insignia. The 505th Intelligence Battalion. The intelligence organization for the Lesotho Special Forces Company. General Mosibo's private spy organization. He had little time to reflect on that, because in front of him were three men seated behind a table. On the other side of the table was a single chair. So they'd staged this. They'd set up this little interrogation facility in the time they'd driven here, which told him volumes. One, they weren't an element that habitually did questioning, because if they had been, they wouldn't have taken the time to turn a classroom into an interrogation facility. They would have just taken him straight into a cell with iron rings and blood on the wall. Two, they weren't that switched on, because the cloth on the wall did little to hide what was behind it. Clearly, it was a little bit of amateur hour, which explained why they hadn't searched his room. Even so, he had to tread lightly, because there was no way he could let on what he was doing here. They worked for General Mosibo, but that meant little. Mosibo wouldn't lift a finger to help him. The men in the room had no idea of the plans in motion, and if they learned it from Johann, Mosibo would deny it, hanging him out to dry. Literally. Not an entertaining thought. The one in the center, a tall reed-like man, said, "Take a seat, please." Johann did. One of the thugs who brought him in began pacing behind him, causing him to want to look over his shoulder. Intimidation. The man on the right had his passport and was flipping through it. Johann said, "What's this about?" The man on the left stared at him, trying to look aggressive. He had almost no neck, a bald head, and deep-set eyes. Johann tried to look suitably intimidated, but the man reminded him of a frog. He spoke, and his English was so bad Johann could barely understand it. "You are an American spy." At the end of the statement, he snorted, an odd, out-of-place utterance. Johann didn't have to feign shock, because it was the last thing he expected. He said, "What the hell are you talking about? I'm from South Africa. I'm a photographer. I only came here to take pictures of your landscape. The Malatsunyani Falls and the highlands." The man on the right slapped the table hard and said, "You lie. Look right here." He held up Johann's passport and pointed, "An H-1 visa for the United States. You work for them." Johann could not believe his bad luck. These men hated the United States for backing the Prime Minister in his fight against General Mosibo, and he was here to help them get exactly what they wanted. But they were blinded by their paranoia. The irony wasn't lost on him that his presence was, in fact, a good reason to be paranoid, or that because he'd worked as a security contractor for a duplicitous asshole in the United States, he was now suspected of being a spy. He'd ended up killing that man, but he couldn't say that here. Wait, that's a mistake. I did have a visa to work in the U.S., but I slaughtered my boss because he was helping terrorists. Don't tell anyone. It's our secret. Probably wouldn't go over too well. Johann said, "Yes, I worked in America. I work all over the world. How does that make me a spy?" The man on the left said, "You know who has you, don't you?" He finished the question with the odd snort, like ending a sentence triggered some visceral phlegm reaction. Johann said, "No, I don't. I have no idea why I'm here. I was told Lesotho was very beautiful, but that's not what I'm saying now." The tall reed in the center said, "You are working with American Special Forces. We know they have a team here. We know they are at the embassy right now." What in the hell? The damn Americans. The news filled Johann with not a small amount of worry, if only because their fear was rooted in something concrete, thus making it harder to dissuade them from their chosen conspiracy. He was sure it was nothing more than a security assessment team provided by the U.S. Special Operations Command to do a routine check, but with the paranoia shown here, that mattered little. They'd probably do the same if a USAID team came in delivering wheat. The frog on the left said, "We know they landed today, and now we want to know why." Johann thought, "You know because the damn embassy told you they'd be coming." But he couldn't show any familiarity with soldiers or embassies. He simply said, "I'm just a photographer. I didn't fly in with any American team. I flew in from Johannesburg by way of Durban." The frog said, "If you're a photographer, where are your cameras?" What is up with that guy? He ignored the quirk because the question put him in a bind. He couldn't lead them back to the hotel, or he'd be spending the next few years in some rotten hole once they saw what he'd done. But not saying anything would look just as suspicious. Time to shift tactics. He became belligerent, raising his voice, against training protocols. "My cameras are in my hotel room, where you snatched me up." He pointed to the man circling behind his chair and shouted, "I offered to show those idiots who brought me here, but they had no interest." That answer seemed to rock them back a bit, giving him hope. Time was not on his side. Sooner or later they'd wonder why he hadn't asked for the South African embassy's help, which was something he most definitely couldn't do. He stood up snarling, "I've had about enough of this shit. Stupid talk of spies and Americans. I'm a South African citizen, here to help your tourism industry, and you treat me like a criminal." The man pacing behind his chair stepped forward and punched him in the kidney, bringing him to his knees in an explosion of pain. He feigned being hurt much worse than he was, thinking, "Okay, that didn't work. Looks like you're fighting your way out." He had no idea how he'd get out of the camp, but was thinking only of one step at a time. He crawled on his knees, hacking spittle like he was incapacitated, searching for the man who'd punched him. He was the one who worried him the most, the hired gun, not the officers behind the table. Take that guy out, and the rest would be easy. His eyes aimed at the floor, he saw the boots of the man just outside of striking range. Still crouching and feigning injury, he shuffled forward on his knees and coiled his legs. He heard, "Stop this!" He turned, and a new man had entered the room. From the reactions of the others, Johann could tell he outranked them all. The man said, "What is going on here?" "Like you don't know." Johann was sure he'd been listening next door, and the violence had been more than he was willing to sanction. Johann waited and saw the expression of the frog go from bewilderment to anger. The frog said nothing, but it was enough for Johann to realize he was right. Whoever the man was, he knew exactly what was happening, and Frog wasn't too happy about being thrown under the bus. The reed in the center rattled off a bunch of sentences in Sesotho, and the man answered. After a back and forth, the center man left the room, and the commander took his spot. At that point, Johann knew his gambit had worked. The roughing up of him with no evidence had spooked the commander, and now he was going to play nice. This he did, apologizing for the inconvenience. Johann said, "So that's it? I'm free to go?" "Yes, but you understand why this happened, correct?" "Fuck no." The words came out as a slap, and the commander leaned back. He said, The Americans are against the LDF. They want Lesotho defenseless. They have relentlessly persecuted our commanding general. And your own country has shown no inclination to help, leading those in power to wonder just what South Africa wants. Johann started to say something, the unwinding conspiracy theories becoming ridiculous. Not least because he was living the very conspiracy on behalf of the man talking, when the commander held up his hand saying, I know, you're just a photographer. A man who knows nothing of such things, but apparently travels all over our capital city without a camera today, stopping at some decidedly strange spots. Johann remained quiet, sensing the end game and not wanting to screw it up. First rule of interrogation. If the interrogator wants to talk, let him. He continued. If, by any chance, you bump into the U.S. ambassador on your sightseeing trips, you might tell him how we feel. Let him know that Lesotho will not tolerate American interference. We don't fear special forces, we have our own, and as I'm sure you've now seen, they're just as good. Johann kept his opinion to himself, realizing that this man truly thought he was a spy and was giving him a message to take back to the U.S. Embassy. The lunacy of the entire situation made him wonder about the general they were supporting. If Masibo was half as crazy as these men, he probably deserved to go. The commander smiled and handed back Johann's passport. He said, Can you relay that, if you get the chance? Yes, of course, but I've told you. Yes, I know. You're just a photographer. A man entered the room with a digital SLR and a piece of paper with handwriting on it. The commander said, You don't mind if we use our own, do you? The man handed the paper to Johann, and he saw it was his name and passport number. He was instructed to place it under his chin like a common criminal, and the man took several photos. When he'd left the room, the commander said, Balin, take him back to his hotel. To Johann he said, But rest assured, we'll be watching, Johann the photographer. Johann nodded and followed Balim out the door. On the silent drive back, he reflected on two things. One, these men were nowhere near as good as Colonel Armstrong thought they were. The cream of their intelligence crop not only never searched his room, they didn't even make him empty out his pockets. It didn't bode well for General Masibo's troops, whom they were currently training. And two, there was a United States Special Forces team on the ground, which made the no-fire box of the U.S. Embassy critical. In no way did he want them involved. This had to be clean. Lesotho against Lesotho. Any fight drawing in the Americans would be a mess of the first order. Balim pulled into his hotel drive-through and put the vehicle in park, not saying a word. Johann exited and for the first time felt the sweat under his shirt. For as amateurish as the interrogation had been, it had still been harrowing and had come close to leading to mission failure. He went up to his room and realized the reconnaissance he'd been sent to do had accomplished exponentially more than he had expected. But he needed to get out, now. No way was he going to ply his cover tomorrow, driving around taking pictures of waterfalls. The only pictures he'd get would be on the mountainous plateau, when he emplaced the beacon for the drop. After that, he intended to be on the first plane smoking out of the country. The next time he'd see Lesotho would be under a parachute canopy, and the three in that room had better hope they didn't end up in his gun sight. 30. Knuckles saw the phone in the team room blink and answered, hearing, "He's here. Just walked in." He said, "Thanks," hung up, then jogged down to the second floor toward Kurt Hale's office. He knocked, and Kurt looked up, a phone to his ear. Kurt said, "Never mind, he's in my doorway." Kurt hung up and said, "What, you have a beacon on my ass or something?" Knuckles grinned and said, "No, sir. I just knew you wanted me here. You still serious about taking me to the Oversight Council meeting?" "Yeah, I'm serious. George is on leave and I need someone to keep me company." Kurt smiled and said, "I can't do these meetings by myself." George Wolfe was the deputy commander of the task force and the natural choice to take to an Oversight Council meeting. Knuckles, an operator, was not, and he knew it. He said, "What about Blaine? Where's he?" Blaine Alexander was the Omega chief. The man who called the shots when an operation was executed to put someone's head on a spike. Once a lieutenant colonel in the Army, he'd controlled every single hit that Knuckles had been on under task force authority. He'd retired from the military and taken a contracting job with the task force, which is to say he was doing the same thing he'd done on active duty. The task force was weird that way. It was a digital machine in the world of the analog government. But it didn't explain why Knuckles was going to an Oversight Council meeting. Kurt said, "Blaine's busy on a project." Kurt looked at him and said, "You afraid of going?" "No, hell no. Just wondering is all." Kurt said, "Well, quit it. There aren't any surprises with me." Knuckles heard the words and wanted to laugh, wondering if Kurt actually believed them. Behind his back, Kurt Hale was called Yoda, and that was for a reason. He never gave an explanation for doing anything and always confounded those around him right up until he was proven correct. There was a purpose behind Knuckles attending the Oversight Council meeting, but maddeningly, Kurt wouldn't say what that was. Knuckles had lived with that for the last 7 years he'd been in the task force, and while it was aggravating, he'd never complained. Because at the end of the day, it usually meant he'd get to put a terrorist down. Kurt exited the office, and Knuckles followed. He said, "Hey, sir, just out of curiosity, why me?" Walking toward the elevator, Kurt said, "You heard the VTC yesterday with Pike, correct?" "Yeah, of course. Pike's got a thread, but we have no idea what it is." "No, I mean, did you hear the VTC? "Okay, Yoda, I'll be your Skywalker." He said, "Yes, sir. What do you mean?" Kurt pressed the button for the elevator, then turned to Knuckles. He said, "How's it going with Carly? How's the training?" The shift of the conversation was pure hail. Knuckles wanted to punch the wall at the change of subject, but he knew Kurt had a reason. He said, "It's going." Nothing more, letting Kurt know he didn't appreciate the shift. The doors opened, and Kurt said, "You know there are a lot of guys hoping she'll fail." Knuckles said, "She won't." Kurt looked at him and said, "You sure about that? Because from what I'm hearing, you'd just as soon she did." Knuckles bristled and said, "She'll do just fine. She switched on and she's got a natural talent. When I'm done with her, she'll smoke most of those assholes talking." Kurt laughed and said, "Touchy, touchy. I'm just sick of the bedroom talk. She's working her ass off, and it's because of her, not me." The door opened and Kurt said, "That's why you're in the elevator with me. I need to know." And Knuckles realized that Kurt was doing a pulse check of his organization, wanting to assess where the real level was. Knuckles said, "Sir, she's good, better than good. And you have no issue with that, since you're no longer..." They exited into the parking garage, and Knuckles said, "Come on, sir, can't she just be judged on her damn skill? Does she have to be the girl who dated an operator?" Kurt said, "No, not at all. My point was, can she work in the task force with you, the guy who used to ball her? Knuckles was incredulous. Did you really just say that, sir? Kurt stopped and faced him. He said, yes, I did. I don't give a shit about political correctness. I care about killing terrorists. And I need to know if this is going to be a problem. Because if it is, she's got no chance at selection. I need to hear it. Knuckles sighed, then said, you know, I'd like to tell you you're right and she needs to go, I really would. But truth be told, she's good. I'll be straight up. I don't want her in the task force. She's headstrong and she's got no off switch. But that's just me talking from a failed relationship. If that hadn't happened, I'd tell you she's better than about half the people in this building. They reached Kurt's car, Kurt circling to the driver's door, and Knuckles waiting on the passenger side. Kurt unlocked the doors, and Knuckles said, she'll do just fine. Kurt said, are you willing to keep training her? Knuckles opened the door and said, are you kidding? Of course. No way is she going to fail. My name is on that chit. They settled into the seats, and Kurt said, you mean that? Yes. Look, sir, we parted ways, but make no mistake, she's talented. I can see it. Pike can see it. Jennifer can see it. I'm not just making it up. And while I don't like the way things ended with us, I do appreciate skill. She's got it. Kurt put the car in drive and said, does she have enough training to do drills on her own for a while? What's that mean? He said, nothing. They drove the rest of the way in silence, passing by the monuments of Washington, D.C. They rolled into the access point for the old executive office building, and after showing identification, were waved through. Kurt parked, and they walked up the steps to the building. Kurt said, you ever been to one of these before? No, I'm not sure why I'm here right now. Kurt laughed and said, it'll become obvious later. We'll enter, you'll go to the back of the room, and I'll brief. Clear? Knuckles said, yeah, clear. What he thought was, clear as mud. Kurt said, just answer what I ask when the time comes. They approached the scrum of people attempting to enter the secure room, and Knuckles said, what the hell does that mean? Kurt shook his head, telling him no more talking. Fuming, Knuckles waited in line, then passed over his cell phone, went through a metal detector, and took a seat at the back of the room, watching the most influential bodies in the United States government gather around and talk as if they were out for a mid-morning tea. It was surreal. The same people he saw discussing death and destruction on Sunday shows were now chatting as if they were deciding where to get brunch. He realized they were, in fact, just people, but powerful nonetheless. The Oversight Council had been designed by Kurt Hale and the previous administration to control task force activities. While the task force operated outside the bounds of the U.S. Constitution, Kurt had known they needed a check, lest they turn into something vile. President Hanister had inherited the task force after the death of the previous president, and he had a choice, disband the unit or embrace it. Initially, he'd been leaning toward disbanding it because he'd seen in past operations the threat the unit posed to the fabric of a democracy. But then he'd learned, the hard way, the good it could do. It wasn't hyperbole to say that the task force had prevented World War III, and Hanister had been the president when it happened. It was the deciding vote to embrace the unit. The council was the sole body that oversaw task force activities. Comprised of 13 people both inside and outside the government, it was a Faustian bargain for those who chose to embrace the responsibility. Get read on to the task force and gain the ability to be in a secret circle that few on Earth knew existed. But to do so meant agreeing to an illegal organization that could cause any member to go to jail for a long, long time. Knuckles wondered how many in the room did it out of patriotism, or simply out of a junior high, "I'm in on a secret" bullshit. Hard to tell. But that was the way of the U.S. government. All would proclaim patriotism, but only a few could look in the mirror and say it wasn't because of ego. 31. No sooner had Knuckles taken a seat at the back than the entire room stood up. President Hannister had entered. Knuckles stood like everyone else, but after seeing the people chatting before, he couldn't get past the feeling that this whole thing was show, with none of the folks on the council assimilating the true seriousness of what was being discussed. President Hannister said, "Good to see you, Kurt. I've only got about 30 minutes to hide in my schedule, so let's get to it." Kurt started his slideshow, going through the various operations, and received no pushback. Knuckles' eyes were glazing over until Kurt reached South Africa. He gave the current assessment and then said, "I'd like to continue with the operation. I know it's weak, but Tyler Malloy is doing something bad, and there's not a lot of risk here. I can't prove a clear and present danger, but Malloy's trying to get a tool that will be harmful to United States interests." Knuckles inwardly chuckled. Trying to get a tool was far removed from acquiring nuclear triggers that are impossible to get. Then the National Security Advisor spoke, and he realized that the crowd wasn't nearly as out of tune as they appeared to be on the Sunday talk shows. "Kurt, your mandate ends with sanctioned terrorist groups. This guy is a U.S. citizen. And yeah, he might be doing something bad, but it's not your problem set. I was against granting you Alpha authority for Tel Aviv to begin with. No way will I agree to further actions in South Africa. Sir, I understand on the surface, but the man I'm following is working with terrorists. Yes, he's an American citizen, but he's also a threat. Do we want to chase the triggers after they're released, simply because they ended up in the hands of a terrorist group we're sanctioned to interdict? That makes no sense." Amanda Croft, the newly minted Secretary of State, voiced her opinion. "And letting you run amok is the answer? How many disparate threats in the future will you find that you need to interdict? How far up the food chain do we hunt? This man is an arms dealer. Scum, yes, but legal scum. Maybe you think we should start hunting the head of Northrop Grumman. Where does it end?" Knuckles was taken aback at the ferocity of the comments. The new Secretary of State was pretty attractive, in a cougar sort of way, and he thought she would be on their side by her appearance, because he was a little bit of a man-whore at heart. He had no idea of the cesspool Kurt waded through on a daily basis to give him the authority to operate. It was an eye-opener. President Hannister held up a hand, and the room grew quiet. He said, "Kurt, do you really feel this is necessary? Do you truly think hunting this man with the task force is in our best interests?" "Yes, I do. He's got something very bad at his core. I admit I don't know what he's up to, but I do know if he gets those triggers, he's going to cause problems." Amanda said, "Problems how?" Kurt looked at her and said, "Problems like a lot of dead people, and a response from the United States that'll cost billions of dollars. It won't happen tomorrow. It's not a ticking time bomb like the movies, but it's real nonetheless. He gets those triggers and he'll sell them to the highest bidder, and whoever buys them will not have our interests at heart." She leaned back and said, "So says the man with a hammer. Everything is a nail." Knuckles saw Kurt smile at her, not the least bit offended. He said, "Ma'am, Sometimes there are actual nails in the world. And I admit, I'm the hammer. Knuckles watched the stare down. She said, Okay, Kurt, convince me. He said, Knuckles, how many men have you killed? Knuckles was brought up short at the utterance of his call sign. He said, Sir? The entire room rotated around to look at him. Kurt said, How many men have you killed? Sir, I don't know. I don't keep a count. Kurt smiled and said, Yes, I guess that was a poor framing of the question. How many men have you killed that could have been prevented? Knuckles now knew why he was in the room, and he believed in the question. He said, Almost every single damn one. The Secretary of State looked at him, and he locked eyes with her. She said, Who are you? Knuckles said, Well, ma'am, I'm not the killer man. I'm the killer man's son. But I do the killing until the killer man comes. Her face scrunched in confusion, and Kurt said, He's a task force operator. He works for you. And what he's telling you is that preventing terrorism is much better than reacting to it. Knuckles nodded, keeping the eye of the Secretary of State, and not because of the current fight. She's a little haughty. He brushed her hair aside, and he saw she had no ring on her hand. She maintained eye contact for longer than necessary, then broke it. He knew it was because of his stare. She said, Okay, Kurt, what are you asking for here? Knuckles realized they'd won, and then wondered if Kurt had brought him here solely for that exchange. Surely he wouldn't do that. I'm an operator, not a piece of meat. He didn't just do that. Kurt said, All I want is Alpha Authority to continue to South Africa. From the data Pike sent, we have a thread of a phone that was used in Tel Aviv. It's now in Cape Town. All I want to do is what we did in Tel Aviv. Just explore. We won't do anything overt. Alexander Palmer, the National Security Advisor, laughed and said, You just briefed us on a damn fiasco in Tel Aviv. What part of that was just exploring? Sir, we wouldn't have this thread if Pike hadn't intercepted the men hunting Shoshana. He took the initiative, and now we are where we are. I don't know the intersection, but I do know it's worth exploring. Palmer said, None of that had anything to do with Tyler Malloy. None. It was all about Pike's misguided loyalty and willingness to ignore orders. You just said he lost the actual thread of Tyler by chasing after these other guys. I disagree. Tyler's chief of security met them in Jaffa just before they began hunting Shoshana. I admit conducting the operation in support of Shoshana caused Pike to lose contact with Tyler, but he had to make a choice, and he determined a clear and present danger that was tied into what Tyler was doing. He opted to focus on the threat, but there's a connection. I just need to find it. Surprisingly, Amanda Croft said, I'm inclined to let them continue, and she glanced at Knuckles when she said it. Knuckles thought, I cannot believe Kurt did that. President Hannister said, I am as well. Palmer, put it to a vote. He did, and Knuckles watched the lethal authority of the United States vote in favor of continued action, all because of his eye contact. The meeting broke up, and he rejoined Kurt on the way out the door. When they were out of earshot, he said, Tell me you didn't just prostitute me. Kurt laughed and said, You ever bend over backward for a pretty face? Knuckles glared at him, and Kurt said, Oh, no, not you, never. Well, I have, and you have a pretty face. Sorry if it's a role reversal, but I met Amanda at her in brief. She's a whore.